Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of our World Cup Today's Football Times. We've moved past the group stage, seamlessly easing our way out of the group, hopefully not on the yellow cards rule or anything like that. We've eased our way through in fine style. Now we're into the last 16. We've got a few more games to look at here, reminiscing about the glory days of World Cups past and how it's far better than it is right now in Qatar. With me this time is Stephen Scragg. How are you doing there, Stephen?
Oh, doing well, Aidan. Looking forward to this. I think we were described as shooting fish in a barrel for kind of like the group stage because you've got so many competitions to consider, so many games, you know. But yeah, the last 16, it focuses the mind a little bit, it which does. Obviously will intensify, I suppose, for quarterfinals and semifinals. But yeah, I mean, with the last 16 as well, it's kind of like it only kicked in properly from 86. All right, you could, I suppose, theoretically go back to 34 and 38, but I'm not going to do that. But, you know, so yeah, it's a narrower eye of the needle to go for this on this.
It
episode.
Is, isn't it? Yeah. Spoiler alert: we didn't pick any from the 30s for this. It would have been a step too far, wouldn't it? But yeah. Well, Dave Bowler's with us also. How you doing, Dave?
Good evening. Down to the knockouts of the proper football. It gets exciting.
Football, then. That's it. It sure does. Well, why don't you kick us off, Dave? Then you can take first pick.
Yeah, in that case, we'll go back to, we won't go back very far, go back to the last World Cup, France against Argentina, which was the first game of the last 16, round of 16, last time around. The French had a pretty grim group. They'd beaten Australia and Peru, largely unconvincingly, and had a 0-0 with Denmark. And of course, as is the way with all World Cups, we were supposed to be coming to see Messi start to take charge of the competition and finally win it. But this game turned out to be the emergence of somebody else. It was Mbappe who really came to the fore in this game. One of the best games of the last World Cup, I think. And right from the outset, it was clear that Mbappe was going to be the man. He set them up for the first goal after about a dozen minutes. It was a terrifying burst of pace around 50 yards. Into the box. Rojo was desperately trying to chase him. Rugby tackled him about three times before he finally got him, pulled him down, and Griezmann scored. And that, he was inches away from an identical penalty on a long Pogba pass not long after that. But I think, you know, what's always interesting is in these World Cups, there's somebody who does come to the fore, somebody who becomes the focal point of the competition. And he was the one that did it in 2018, obviously, and this game was the one where he really did take flight, I suppose. I mean, Argentina, to be fair to him, kept in the game. Di Maria buried one from 30 yards just before half time, and they took the lead early on in the second half. Mercado turned a messy shot just past the goalkeeper. I think you can deliberate over whether it was a deliberate interception or not, but it was a pretty decent goal. And then the French really turned the wick up after that. Pavard scored that fantastic goal from the edge of the box. It was a laser-like right-footed shot from the edge of the area. It was curling and spinning and arcing into the far corner. And the TV camera scored that one perfect because they were directly behind him as it flew in. And then after that, it was when Mbappe really took charge of the game. His first goal was a nice first touch to drag the ball into space, and then he exploded a low shot through the goalkeeper and in. Four minutes later, the French sliced Argentina open. First-time pass from Matuidi to Giroud. Another first-time pass to the right, and Mbappe appeared like Carlos Alberto on the right edge of the box to crash his shot in. So that was the game pretty much done. Argentina got a late consolation. But you know, as I say, the big thing with that game that you remember for me was Mbappe, you know, the first teenager to score twice in the game since Pele in 58. And with him really coming to the coming to the fore, coming to the party. The French were starting to look a team that could go on and win the World Cup. Obviously, the runners-up in the European Championships a couple of years before. Pogba was becoming a bigger and bigger influence. And that was the game, I think, that set the tone for those final stages of that World Cup.
Oh, it was definitely an incredible game, wasn't it? I remember this really well, partly not because I've got to watch it all properly, because oddly enough, I remember so well, this was my wife's 40th birthday. We were around at her parents' house and I had to keep ducking in and out of the living room to try and see what was going on. Every time I went in, there seemed to have been another goal and I tried to hang on and try to see as many of them as I could. I've clearly got over the fact that I missed bits of this game, clearly. You're absolutely right about Mbappe there, how he came to the fore in this game and he just went strength to strength throughout the World Cup from this point on. I recently watched a documentary about this French team. I can't even remember what it was called, but it was sort of behind the scenes type documentary. And one thing that stuck in my mind about Mbappe was a team talk during the group stage. I don't know which game it was after, but Deschamps was singling Mbappe out for a little bit of criticism of saying, well, you're not using your biggest asset, Kylian. I'm paraphrasing here. I'm sure he put it rather more eloquently than this, but you know, you're not using your biggest asset, which is your pace. And if you use your pace, you'd be able to terrify people. And obviously in this game against Argentina, that's exactly what he did. And you're right. Every time he went through, the only way they could stop him was to bring him down. And it's a question of whether they did it before he reached the penalty area or after in some cases. He was just electrifying. And he got it right in this game. But what an incredible game it was all around. 4-3. I guess we were nearly set up for a repeat of this in the last 16 coming up in Qatar, weren't we, until Argentina managed to get themselves top of the group. But yeah, it was a hell of a match, that one, Stephen, wasn't it, in 2018?
It was. I mean, this was a game that kind of flew in the face of all of us saying that World Cups don't throw up, you know, legendary games anymore. You know, this one will stand the test of time. Yeah. I mean, I think it was a podcast not so long ago where I said, you know, people, you can only really properly consider a World Cup 20 years after the event or properly appreciate it. You need that detachment from it. But, you know, I think we'll all look back on this one, you know, as being, you know, up there with the very best. I mean, it swung one way, then the other. That fragility of Argentina's as well. I mean, you know, if you think about the 1990 World Cup team being such a dysfunctional one that should never have got anywhere near the 1990 World Cup final yet. Ever since then, I don't think there's been a bad Argentinian collective that have gone to a World Cup. I think they've constantly gone to World Cups with excellent squads and a serious chance at winning the prize, and they've only returned to the final once. But there's been a few occasions, and you know, particularly the Messi era as well, where, you know, each passing World Cup, you think, this has to be the one. This has to be the one. And I think with 2022, it either has to be or it'll never will be now. But yeah, I think 2018, I don't think anyone's really looking at Argentina going out of the World Cup quite so early. You know, maybe only when Maradona led them, was it 2010? You know, yeah. that complete and utter, you know, feeling of, you know, where is this going to go? Certainly compared to 4 years early when it was Jose Peckerman, and I think they had the best team at that World Cup. You know, this was, again, another amazing collective. And you know, on paper, or theoretically, you're looking at that game and thinking Argentina have the beaten of France, because this is a French team that are just 2 years on from having lost on home soil in the European Championship final. You know, and obviously that's a position England are in, I suppose, now in 2022. And it's, you know, it's how you respond to such a bitter blow, because it's got to be a huge blow to lose, you know, a major international senior final on home soil, and then be expected to go and do what they did. And for France to go on and win in 2018, that's a huge achievement. You know, it might not have the charm necessarily of 1984 or even Euro 2000, which is an understated, you know, work of art. You know, I think, yeah, you know, in the last episode, we spoke of these forks in the road and where teams went from, you know, certain results. You know, for France to use this as the springboard to success, you know, maybe this was the result that, I don't know, kind of erased the pain of 2016 and said, right, we can look ahead now and take the prize this time around.
Yeah, I think there's a lot in that, because I think when they hadn't been amazing in the group stage, had they? Well, neither had Argentina, for that matter. They nearly went out in their last group match, Nigeria, I think it was a very close call in the final game for Argentina in the group. But France, as much as they sort of came through top, they weren't, you know, they weren't blowing teams away, were they? You know, they really struggled against Australia. A late goal to win that one. It was nothing particularly great. And I guess this game, this victory against, as you say, a great collective, gives you the confidence to go. Exactly, yeah. And then this went from strength to strength.
It's the springboard.
You compare it to that Maradona team in 2010. That Maradona team went further than this one, bizarrely. They reached a quarterfinal. Yeah. And yet this was a finer team, surely.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it really was the springboard, this result. This set them up to be able to, you know, to go forth and win that second World Cup. And, you know, it was an incredible game that, I don't know, it just seemed to be Argentina's for the taking at various stages of the game, only for France to power through. You know, in a way that they can do from time to time. You know, they do have this strength to be able to brush teams aside that might be expecting a result against them. I think sometimes teams go in against France feeling like they've got, I don't know, a bit of a soft touch coming up and an almost guaranteed result, but you know that there's a confidence in teams in playing France sometimes that is misguided. And I think this is where Argentina were in this one.
What do you think that Pavard goal, Dave? Is there being a finer goal from a Frenchman in a World Cup? I'm trying to think.
It's difficult to think of one, isn't it? And I mean, you know, it was one of those that was, there was a lot of fortune involved in terms of us watching it, because there was a fantastic camera angle directly behind him, and the way the ball sort of arcs and spins and worms its way around the goalkeeper into the far corner. But, you know, if your right back's scoring a goal like that, then I think you've got every reason to expect that it's going to be your day. But, you know, again, just coming back to Mbappe, just the way he kind of announced himself on the world. And, you know, there he was as a teenager. And by the end of that competition, he had already imprinted his name on a World Cup. And that was his World Cup in sort of shorthand terms. You know, and you look at poor old Messi, and here he is, World Cup number 5. And he still hasn't quite done that. You know, probably the greatest player of the 21st century, some will argue the greatest player of all time. And he still hasn't managed to do that in a World Cup, probably with a more promising team around him, as you say, than necessarily you looked at that French side at the time. It's I wonder, you know, if he doesn't come through this time, you know, which has got to be his last chance. I wonder how, you know, when we are looking back at football in 20, 30 years, just whether that will tarnish his legacy a little bit, that he didn't on the, you know, in the biggest stage of all, that he didn't quite dominate a tournament.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? You kind of think not, but maybe the fact that he's Argentinian, maybe it will, because obviously there's the comparisons to you know who that need to come in there, don't they? And if he was from a lesser footballing nation, let's say, then his image wouldn't be, or his legacy, sorry, wouldn't be tarnished in any way by not winning a World Cup purely because he's Argentinian. Yeah. That's a harsher measurement, perhaps.
I think so. I mean, you know, there is that expectation that, you know, obviously the Maradona Cup comparison is the obvious thing, but with the players that they've had around him over that period, to have not won it, but not to have just not won it, but also not to have been the dominant personality the way that we would have expected him always to be at a World Cup, you know, I think that's perhaps we're judging him too highly just because of who he is and all of that kind of baggage that goes with that, but I wonder if that will be, you know, just something missing from the, you know, the completing the picture.
Well, we'll soon see how they deal with Australia in the last 16 in Qatar, won't we? Have they've just got themselves through to now? Anyway, Stephen, what's your first pick for tonight?
I'm going back to a tournament where someone has written a book about this tournament, the 1986 World Cup. Funnily enough,
and what a great topic!
And again, I know, what a great topic! What a great topic to pick. It's a tournament that has a couple of certainly more than one choice here that you could go for. But I've gone for, rather than, you know, the one that a shirt that I own should lean me towards, I've instead gone for Belgium 4, the Soviet Union 3. Just one of the most ridiculous games of football that the World Cup has ever known. I'm not sure, I've read it, I don't know how true it is, but this is the only game where someone scored a hat-trick in the World Cup and ended up on the losing side. The magnetic Igor Belanov, you know, he was just at the peak of his powers at this point in time. He's just won the Ballon d'Or, just been part of a Dynamo Kiev side that's won the Cup Winners' Cup for the second time in the history. You know, everything he is touching turns to gold. He's been fantastic in the group stages. He's really kind of like stepped up as well, because Oleg Protasov isn't fully fit and his World Cup is kept to a bare minimum. I don't think the two shared time on the pitch together. I think Protasov's only time on the pitch, the 86 World Cup, was as a substitute, you know, swapping in for Belanov towards the end of the group stages. But Belanov was just magnificent in this game, as he had been throughout the tournament. But Belgium defied the odds. They've been, incredibly ordinary in qualifying. Were exceptionally minimal. Came in completely under the radar. A familiar name for recent tournaments. They'd qualified for World Cups and European Championships. Reached the 1980 European Championship final. They've been a staple of major international tournaments. But yeah, they've been unremarkable in qualifying. They'd scraped through the group stages in third place. One of those four teams to utilize a third place finish at this tournament. And I think they were fully expected to be blown away, and the fact that they'd lost Van der Eyken as well, they were weakened as well. They lost one of the star players, but they just kept on coming back for more. It was an incredible game of football that just swung one way and the other, and Belgium's answer to Belanov being the amazing Jan Koolemans, who just seemed to be key and pivotal to absolutely everything they did in this game. It really did beg a belief. It was almost a prosaic game. Belanov had scored just before the half-hour mark. We were approaching not far off the hour, and it didn't particularly look like Belgium were going to come into the game yet they did. Emphatically, Schifo scores. Belanov scores again, but then Koolemans gets the equaliser. There's a lot of rancour over whether it's offside or not. A lot of arguments over how this game was panning out. It goes into extra time. De Marle and Klassen score. Tottenham fans will remember Nico Klassen very well from that era. He stood out as being this enigmatic star for Tottenham. In an era where foreign players were still, a rarity as such. They were there, but it was still a huge thing for a British club to buy a foreign player as such. But yeah, and Belanov, completes his hat-trick. There's still 9 minutes to play at 4-3. Yet, Belgium keep them at bay and kind of break a lot of people's hearts there, because there is another big result in the last 16 that I think we're going to come to very soon that, kind of just... I don't know, it kind of put a dampener on the World Cup, the 1986 World Cup, for at least a short period of time, because two of the best teams, arguably the best two European teams at the 1986 World Cup, crashed out of the tournament, in such close proximity, in such ludicrous circumstances as well.
When they would have been facing each other next as well, wouldn't they? Well, I think
Reading
things on this game, I think it's to Russian Soviet minds, this was an absolute scandal of a result because of these offside calls, as you mentioned there, that Belgium earned themselves or got the fortune of at various stages in the game. And it could easily have gone a different way. It's Belgium ended up in the semi-finals as well. It's what you have to remember. It's like where they ended up as a result of this and what they were able to do next. They ended up in the semi-final, which they've only just bettered in 2018, really, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. It made little sense because they lost players, influential players, hand over fist as the tournament progressed, yet the results got better as they did so. Because they would go on and knock Spain out, who obviously we'll come to Spain again in a little bit. But, again, everyone expected Spain to win that face-off between the two of them in the quarterfinals. So, it was only Maradona that kind of stopped Belgium in their tracks in that semi-final. So to to spring this kind of surprise, really. You know, like I say, they've been exceptionally dull in qualifying. I think they've only scored about six goals in qualifying or something like that. Finished third in the group stage. Looked totally incapable of what was to come. But to do it with the players that they'd lost as well, it is one of the most ridiculous turns of events of that World Cup.
And they only qualified through a playoff, didn't they? They were second in the group. I can't remember who behind, but it was a playoff win over the Dutch.
It was a playoff win over the Dutch. And again, they came within about 4 minutes or so of not qualifying. It was a late winner that clinched them that place, because it was a complete reversal of 1974 when, you know, Belgium had scored what was a perfectly legitimate winning goal against the Dutch in qualifying that would have stopped total football in its tracks had it counted. So there was this reversal for 1986 where Belgium had clawed qualification from the jaws of defeat. And then to go on all the way to that semi-final, it was, you know, it is one of the most, you know, fascinating stories of that World Cup. But yeah, this game, this 4-3 against what was an exceptional Soviet Union side. And that's the juddering thing about it, is that there's this unremarkable, you know, Belgian side that had laboured to the World Cup, that had seemed in a sorry state during the qualifying in the group stages, to suddenly explode into life the way they did in that game against a powerhouse of a Soviet Union side that had put six past, you know, Hungary. You know, that team was just dripped in talent, and it was a proper gravity-defying turn of events.
Sure, you say they didn't quite stop total football in its tracks in 73, 74 when they, by right, should have done. Here they've stopped the Lobanovsky version of it, haven't they? The Soviet-Ukrainian version of it. What do you reckon, Dave? It's quite a dramatic game.
It was, I mean,
in a dramatic tournament.
The Soviets, as Stephen said, you know, they had a great group, and they topped the group with France, who had just won the European Championships a couple of years before, coming second. So, I mean, to finish above that French team was an achievement in itself. But I was watching the goals earlier on today, just as a reminder, and Belanov, his first goal is a 25-yard screamer. And in commentary, Big Ron is there saying, "You won't see a better goal in the tournament than that." Famous last words there, Ron.
Well, yes. Just wait a couple of days.
there might be a couple come along. But,
yeah.
But I would take that, yeah. But, I mean, yeah, looking at the goals, I mean, yeah, you can understand why they were... They were scandalised over potential offside decisions because the different camera angles, so you can't really see back then as you would now. But I mean, they're either miles offside or the defending is off the scale terrible. I mean, Kuhlmann is standing there on his own with about 10 yards of space when that long ball comes forward to score the second one. Schifo, I mean, there's nobody anywhere near him when he equalises in the first place. So, I mean, either they were entirely focused on getting forward, or there were some refereeing decisions that were had something left to be desired. And we'll be coming on to refereeing decisions again a bit later on, I think.
We may well do, yes.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, everything. It was that there was that. That was kind of the thing with the Soviet Union, wasn't it? In that sort of period, I don't know what. I guess sort of 82 to 88. They always looked as though they ought to go and win something. I mean, it was such a good team, and it was that team in 86. I think it was seven players from Dynamo Kiev in the starting lineup, I think. So having your national team based around a club side as well, so they knew one another inside out. So they weren't just a really good team with great players in it, but they'd got that cohesion that they would have from playing week in, week out. And I guess the way the Hungarians, if you go back to the early 50s, when their national team effectively played as a club side. And it's just one of those, again, where when you look back, they should have done more than they did. And somehow, every time, it just got stopped by somebody. But you would never have seen this result coming. I mean, you would have, this would have been a coup and buster, wouldn't it, really, back in 86?
Well, it's not the only one, because there's another coupon buster. Now, Stephen's already alluded to it, and I guess the main reason Stephen didn't get to talk about Denmark is because I'd already picked it. So the other last 16 game that we'll talk about from 86 is the Denmark-Spain game. Now, this was, well, talk of astonishing scorelines. I mean, teams not getting their just desserts. Right? This is a remarkable 5-1. Sounds like a demolition, but, you know, that's not quite how it went. It's a bizarre, bizarre game. Now, Denmark, this is Danish Dynamite Denmark, of course. You know, they'd been great at Euro 84, although those of us in this country may not have seen that. They got to the semi-finals, and who did they run into there? It was Spain, who knocked them out on penalties. Spain would become their nemesis, not just 84 and 86, but again, further down the line, 93, knocking them out of the 94 World Cup qualifying as well. But this was a Denmark that played some spectacular football. There was that 6-1 thrashing of Uruguay, which is you know, much celebrated on YouTube clips and all of that. You know, Laudrup and Elkjær, they were in their prime, dovetailing perfectly. You know, dynamic, all-action, energetic skills of Elkjær. And then the slightly more silky, elegant and refined talents of Laudrup. Together, put them together, it was just sheer magnificent attacking style. They also had plenty of others, you know, Arneson, Jesper Olsen, Søren Lerby, Morten Olsen, all doing it in an extremely cool kit that Stephen was mentioning as well, which just adds to the appeal, as we all know. They'd been brilliant in the qualifiers, as they had in Euro 84. They had played a terrific qualifier against the Soviet Union that we've just been talking about as well, where it was end-to-end stuff. Both teams could have scored any number of goals. Denmark came out on top, and we were denied the opportunity to see that again in a quarterfinal because they both got dumped out when they possibly shouldn't have been. But yeah, the Denmark team had come to an even wider consciousness, I guess, in Mexico 86 because it was a World Cup. But I guess it was the end of the Danish Dynamite era, and it ended in this game, ironically, with the same person who'd kind of kick-started it with his equalizing goal against England in the Euro 84 qualifiers when he ran through a struggling English defence to rescue a draw, as it was on that occasion. But really, that was Denmark showing their fine style and getting the least they deserved out of that game. That the same player, Jesper Olsen, ended up being, I don't want to say the villain, but the unfortunate one to trigger this unhappy situation was unfortunate. Now, Spain had come through a group in Mexico behind Brazil, but they hadn't impressed particularly. You know, they edged past Northern Ireland and then beat Algeria. Certainly nothing compared to what Denmark had been like in their group. But Spain did have a certain Emilio Butragueño, of course, the vulture, who I guess was ready for the kill in this case. Denmark came into this game without Frank Arneson. I think this is really, really crucial to what happened. He'd got a red card in the final group match of West Germany for a completely ridiculously unnecessary challenge on Lothar Matthäus. But there's more to that, as there usually is. You know, his wife had recently got taken ill, and his mind was on other things, and whether he should have played that game when Denmark really didn't have to do that much is another consideration. But he was out, and therefore that slight adjustment coming into this game because of that very influential player. Now, I remember this game, watching it. I was at school at the time. I was 11 going on 12. Now, this was a late night game in Mexico, so I had to set the video, as you did in those days, set my VCR to make sure it recorded, and I got up in time to watch it in the morning, but I had to keep fast-forwarding bits because I'm trying to get through it all before school. But there was so much going on, and you know, as you skip through, if I just skipped to the result and seen it was a 5-1, you would naturally assume this is Denmark. I'd just seen them thrash Uruguay only a week or so earlier. You'd naturally assume that Denmark were the ones who'd won 5-1. And that's the way even the game started. You know, they took the lead. It was through a penalty, Jesper Olsen scoring the goal. From there, it kind of seemed, well, the pattern that they'd set in the group would continue. You know, they'd go on to comfortable victories, or at least victories. That was the expected outcome. They'd ease their way through. But Jesper Olsen, his moment of infamy, unfortunately, was a no-look pass back to his goalkeeper. And his goalkeeper wasn't where he thought he was. Butragueño was there instead. And suddenly Spain are level. Now, this was just before half time, which I guess probably adds to it a little bit in that it's an unfortunate time for a goal to concede, which changes the complexion of the game. But there was no gung-ho nature to their response immediately. Even when they then went 2-1 down shortly after halftime, again, still no gung-ho response just yet. They kept plugging away. They kept playing as they had done. They'd been dominant. They'd had all the possession. They'd been creating more chances. The natural assumption was the chances will come. They just need to keep going and keep playing. And that's what they did. They fell 3-1 behind to a penalty. And still it was kind of, you know, they were just still working away, doing their thing, creating the chances. It was only in the closing stages where they really had to go hell for leather because it was all seemingly lost. And then they got picked off by a couple more Butragueño strikes towards the end. That's where it becomes harsh. It becomes too brutal, too much. Five was too much. It was a shame for the way it went. Butragueño got 4, of course. Spain got 5. Painfully big defeat. It just seemed a little bit unfair. And speaking of unfair, Jesper Olsen, apparently even to this day, someone who makes a complete clanger in a match. It's called a richtig Jesper Olsen, a right Jesper Olsen is what you've done, which is, well, it's something to be remembered for, I guess, but maybe not the best thing. But, I mean, I don't know. What an unfortunate way for it to end. It's as though they shone so brightly that when they fizzled out and faded away, well, they couldn't fade away. It just had to fizzle out with a instantly. And suddenly what was so good was suddenly all gone. What do you think, Stephen?
Oh, I think, as you said before, Frank, the sending off of Frankie Arnesson at the end of that West Germany game was just so pivotal to how this game went. They played exceptionally well against West Germany. They made changes for that game. You know, they'd already won the opening two games. They'd beaten Scotland. They'd beaten, you know, absolutely steamrolled Uruguay in such style. You know, and they totally bossed West Germany. You know, with despite having made all these changes to the side, but they are Arnesson's needless sending off 2 minutes from time, you know, in retaliation to Lothar Matthäus, who was the pantomime villain of the piece of the 1986 World Cup until Diego Maradona, you know, usurped him somewhat so spectacularly. But yeah, the loss of Frank Arnesson was huge. And another one was that, you know, Jan Molby had played in that West Germany game, and he'd been on the periphery of the side. In the first two games, Molde played against West Germany, and it was a beautifully balanced side. You know, Michael Laudrup would drop deep, you know, push up, and you know, it was a very progressive side that was way ahead of its time. But it worked so well. So the loss of Frank Arnesson, you know, Piontek picks a completely different midfield for this game against Spain. You know, he omits Molby, but drops Molby back down to the bench. Morten Olsen steps up from central defence / sweeper to play in midfield. But, you know, he can't really hold it together, you know, because he's got Jesper Olsen wide of him on one flank. And, you know, it's just such a sparse midfield, really, you know, to lose Arnesson and take Molby out of the picture as well was just an open invitation for Spain to flood forward. And that's a wonderful Spanish side as well. You know, Michel pulling the strings in midfield, Butragueño taking the, you know, advantage of every opportunity that seemed to fall his way. Like you said before, it was a game where this wasn't a, you know, particularly terrible performance from Denmark. You know, it was an end-to-end game. And for a spell in that second half, it was like every time Spain went forward, they seemed to score. Every time that Denmark went forward, they contrived not to score. You know, if this game had ended 5-5, it wouldn't have you know, looked out of place for the game that it was. Yet, you know, Denmark spurned opportunity upon opportunity. You know, the Elkjær, you know, kept on finding space, kept on finding the positions. The opportunities fell his way, but he was denied, you know, by profligacy. You know, the saves of Andoni Zubizarreta. It was a magnificently wild game. You know, unlike the Belgium Soviet Union game, where, you know, Belgium kind of defied the odds and pulled out this performance that everything that had come beforehand suggested was unlikely. You know, Spain had been a bit sluggish in the group stages, but they played exceptionally well against Brazil and not got the just rewards from that game, a game in which the ball went over the line, when it hit the underside of the crossbar, went over the line. They, you know, it was a goal that wasn't given, that should have been given. They lost narrowly. You know, they overcame Northern Ireland in a kind of revenge mission from 4 years earlier, but still went a bit rabbit in the headlights when they gifted Colin Clark that goal. So, you know, there were the ghosts of 86 for them to get over. But this was a Spanish side that had, you know, evolved from just 2 years earlier when they'd redeemed themselves and reached the European Championship final. So, you know, it was no surprise that Spain stepped up and gave Denmark a game. You know, the result jars, you know, massively. And the bizarre thing for Butragueño is that he went on such a dry spell after this game as well at international level. You know, Spain would go out in the quarterfinals, you know, Euro 88 qualifying, he failed to score. You know, he hit a 2 year barren patch after this. You know, it was feast then famine. You know, there's so many complexity. And ironically as well, what would be part of Spain's undoing was similar to what was Denmark's undoing, whereas Denmark suffered because of the loss of Arnesen to suspension. Gokocea, you know, picked up a yellow card in this one, which ruled him out of the quarterfinal. So, you know, that was a huge blow, you know, for Spanish hopes in the quarterfinal against Belgium. So it was a strange domino effect almost. You know, what had come before the game for Denmark against Spain was so damaging for them. What came, you know, for Spain that was so, you know, emphatic in the victory was also part of the downfall, you know, 3-4 days later in the quarterfinal.
What do you think, Dave? Another spectacular game. In the same section, as we say, the winners of the two games we've been talking about were playing each other in the next round, and it could or should have been a different way in many people's minds on both counts.
It's interesting that Denmark team of that period, it reminds me a little bit about what we were talking about in the first of these, about the group games, about Brazil 82. And I mean, you know, they should have gone on and won that World Cup. And I probably still haven't got over that, really, 40 years later. But, you know, there's something about a team that's got all that quality, all that attacking intent, has got that flair and that excitement about them, and yet can spectacularly fall apart. Not that they fell apart in this game particularly, but, you know, that they can have that kind of a result in them. And I wonder if in Denmark, you'll perhaps know better than me, but I wonder if that team is looked on more fondly even than the team that won the Euros 6 years later.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that team obviously hadn't qualified for the competition, and it came from nowhere, and, you know, all the stories, they were on the beach and they formed together. That wasn't a particularly easy on the eye team that won that, but it won. This team had its fantastic moments on a quite regular basis, but it had got that vulnerability, and I always think that is something that makes a team more attractive than one that is just consistent and just steamrolls its way and takes everything before it knocks them over. You know, I think when you're looking at it's the kind of the Marilyn Monroe effect or something in football, isn't it? It's that kind of fragility about it that draws you towards it rather than the team that is just so efficient and carries all before it. But I mean, yeah, you look back at that World Cup and at the end of the group stage, you would have said Denmark, well, they're one of the teams that might go and win this thing. And then all of a sudden, thanks to about, what, 30 mad minutes, they're out of the competition. And, you know, coming back to what I said right at the start, that for me is why cup football is the pinnacle of the game, you know. League football, groups, whatever, will always give you the best team. Doesn't always give you the best fun, though, does it?
No, no, you're absolutely right. Absolutely right, because you need that jeopardy, but you need, well, the best team doesn't have to win, and that's the beauty of it. That's why we all love football, isn't it, partly? And you talk about this Denmark team compared to the 92 one. I think for us as neutral observers, absolutely we would eulogise this one more, but I think it's the same in Denmark too. You've got to remember this was their first great team,
yeah,
or at least the first for a long, 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 long time, maybe way back in the early Olympic days. They had, you know, strength as well, but, you know, that's a totally different time. this was their rise. So to have risen from almost nowhere in international football terms to suddenly spring to Euro 84, where before that they barely registered beyond last place in groups and things like that, to suddenly come up to that and then followed up with this, and the performances, obviously the 6-1 against Uruguay being the one that's imprinted most on people's minds. The style, the manner of it, I think, yeah, to Danish minds as well, this is still where they always look back to. All right, Stephen, I know the last sentence in your book about Mexico 86 references this team as well, doesn't it?
It does. They should definitely have won this World Cup. They were, you know, a joy to watch. And this game kind of, I don't know, it broke the heart, really. You know, they went on to qualify for the 1988 European Championships, but you know, in a frugal nature. You know, scored a handful of goals. I think they did it with a collection of goalless draws and 1-0 wins. They were never quite the same entity again. You know, they'd come to within a penalty shootout and reach the 1984 European Championship. But, you know, that was a glorious ride, and it didn't matter that, you know, they'd fallen at the last hurdle, because the 1986 World Cup was going to come, and, you know, they were the heirs to total football. They were that good. You know, the movement off the ball was incredible. You know, they just played in that wonderful way in which the best teams do, and you know, it's almost like formations become redundant. You know, they're just, you know, football, you know, when it comes to formations, it's kind of like talking about football as being Subutio, and you know, and some human teams play almost as Subutio, and it's when they're in regression and, you know, they constrict themselves and then they will curl up into a ball, into a fetal position, and, you know, protect what they've got, even if the you know, the trailing by a narrow scoreline, because there's always that hope that you might hit hit the jackpot with a set piece or something to grab a draw. You know, but then the best of them go out there and just play so fluidly. And it's all about shapes around the ball and position, you know, areas on the pitch to populate, and there's a lot of simplicity within it as well. You'll have one player who will be handed three different kind of tasks or have three different roles to play, you know, depending on where the ball is on the pitch, and it's all that type of stuff. It's not particularly complex. It can be a simple thing, and this is what this Denmark did. They pulled it off magnificently, and this result was just, I don't know, it was unwarranted, unexpected. But at the same time, I think a lot of us didn't, I don't know, they could accept it because it was Spain, because they were the great dark horse that we all felt would win something one day. You know, it would still take, a decade, two and a half decades until that started to actually happen. But yeah, this result broke that Denmark, that Danish dynamite. And that's the thing, it's Richard Møller-Nielsen is the man who takes them on to go on to win the 1992 European Championship, who was, you know, Piontek's right-hand man, you know, throughout those glory days, or not quite so glory days, of Danish dynamite. And it's the fact that, you know, he takes the lessons of that and pulls off this pragmatic success that is nowhere near as likeable as 1984 and 1986 is for them, because the football was that glorious. You know, you can look at Brazil 1970, and they, you know, one of the rarities of being able to pull off both sides of that act and be able to put the football on display that is so perfect and take the prize. You know, everyone else before and after that, it's never quite fallen into place. And that Denmark ticks this box. Yes, they went out of the last 16, which is, you know, the first hurdle of the knockout stages, but I'd argue that they were still the best team at the 1986 World Cup.
Well, it's a theme of another book, I think, Stephen, of the beauty that's unfulfilled, that you have to sacrifice victory if you want to be remembered for the beauty. And that was obviously what this Denmark team had. Total football on fast forward is how it was described in Danish Dynamite, which I think is a perfect way of talking about them.
Yeah.
Anyway, do you want to push us forward another 4 years to go from one of your favourite World Cups to one of your least, Stephen?
Yes, well, 1990. As harsh as I am on the 1990 World Cup, and I am. You know, I think great demands on it. I think you know, the bizarre thing about the 1990 World Cup is that I want to love it, you know, unconditionally, and I can't quite, because it's that style over substance, you know. it's like the great, you know, one of the, like the greatest, you know, wrapped gift ever. It's not the gift that's the greatest thing, it's the packaging. You open up the gift and there's just an empty box inside that's smaller, and it's that's all there is, or it's a balloon that floats off into the ether. You know, there is no great present in there. It's all sleight of hand, and you know, it's very much the end of bullseye, and some, you know, going for the star prize, and someone's hit the high 90s and not quite the 101. You know, look what you could have won. But as a tournament, it had snapshot images of promise without delivering. You know, the iconic games and all that type of stuff. There is no France 3, West Germany 3. There is no Brazil 3, Brazil 2, Italy 3, or anything like that in this World Cup. But there is kitchen sink dramas. There's all of that, and I think one of the biggest ones is the last 16 clash between West Germany and the Netherlands. You know, two years on from the Netherlands having knocked out West Germany in their own European Championship finals, all of the historical context to it. This is the Netherlands' first World Cup in 12 years. Sizable proportion of their players have won a European Cup that season. Many others have won them within the last 2 or 3 years. But this is an angrier Netherlands. You know, it's one of those tournaments where they're not seeing eye to eye with each other. There's a certain anger about them, and you know, this explodes within not much more than 20 minutes of the game starting, where Frank Rijkaard and Rudi Völler are packed off to the dressing room to the stereotypical early shower, which one needs more than the other, as Rudi Völler has a rather horrendous perm problem, shall we say. But it is one of the most iconic images of this World Cup. But yeah, you know, West Germany, a peculiarity at that World Cup, because the winner always state that the best team at the 1990 World Cup, but, you know, hard to like. But they played exceptionally well in the group stages. They played great. You know, they beaten the hipsters' favourites. You know, Yugoslavia 4-1 in their opening game. They put 5 past the UAE. We're on the brink of a late victory against Colombia until Freddie Rincon scores a wonderful equaliser. You know, and then, you know, they deal admirably with the Netherlands. You know, there's 2 fantastic goals that Germany score in this game. You know, Bremer and I think is it Klinsmann gets the other one. And then you've got Koeman scores a penalty very, very late on to you know, re-alive in the game. But now this is a game that in goal scoring terms only springs to life in the last 10 minutes. But it's that utter, just horrendousness of the Rijkaard Völler incident that will forever hang in mind, because that gob that dangled from his hair, it almost made it look like a dangling earring. I think that just it just stuck in the mind as much as, say, Tardelli's celebration in 82 for a very long time.
From the sublime to the ridiculous, right? It was so memorable. That incident was remarkable, though. It's so utterly uncharacteristic of Rijkaard. He's so mild-mannered. I don't know what happened to him on that day. It's bizarre. But yes, it is so utterly memorable. And it made the game more of a classic because of that incident and what happened after. And Klinsmann's goal and the way he sort of leapt around celebrating after his nice finish, and Bremer's curling shot as well. It was all kicked off, I guess, by that incident, wasn't it? It became great.
It was. It was utterly shocking at the time because, as it would be now, but I think it took everyone by. And it seemed to take kind of like West Germany. It took West Germany into a bizarre different direction because, you know, there's 4 games that they've played. They scored 12 goals. They're very fluid. They're playing some fantastic football. And then from there, you know, they win a quarterfinal against Czechoslovakia that's decided by a penalty, you know, a Mateus penalty. They win the semi-final on penalties. You know, the one goal they score in regulation times as this mad deflection off Paul Parker. And then they win the final from the penalty spot. You know, so there's 2 versions, and it's almost like, you know, this actually very attractive, fluid version of West Germany kind of is chopped off at the end of this game. It's almost like, you know, they're so morally outraged by what happened between Rijkaard and Völler, they just turn to this I don't know, ugly pragmatism to get themselves over the line.
It's like they washed all the magic out of Voller's hair along with the gob.
It was a bit like, you know, was it Take That who famously didn't wash the hair because it was one of the, you know, the chemicals in the shampoo. It was like West Germany became the Take That of the 1990 World Cup.
Well, Dave, what are you going to say about that?
I think it does say a lot about the World Cup of 1990. Stephen's right, it is a hugely overrated tournament. That one of the most iconic images is somebody being spat at. I mean, that kind of... I think the other iconic image...
Spat at, crying, that's the other big image, and somebody wiggling the hips when they're too old to do that. These images...
You can probably throw in Gary Lineker having an accident on the pitch as well. It's all about the bodily fluids, really, the 1990 World Cup, and none of them are pleasant.
And then you've got Franz Beckenbauer on the sideline wearing these unfeasibly huge glasses, looking like a sort of a minor villain from Murder, She Wrote or something.
I was watching the footage of this. What really struck me was just how much the 1990 version of Franz Beckenbauer looked like Cliff Richard. That was one of my biggest takes from this. What people tend to forget is that Franz Beckenbauer also had the Christmas number one at the end of this year.
Oh dear. This was the same day, incidentally, that Argentina and Brazil played as well in Italia 90. So it was quite a heavyweight day. But yes, both memorable and both interesting, but not necessarily all for the football on display in both cases.
It was one of the great pantomime villain days, really, though. I think people looking at those two fixtures are surely wanting Brazil and the Netherlands to progress, and obviously neither of them did. Oh, Argentina and West Germany would go on to share an utterly abject final.
Well, this Dutch team were a shadow of the 88 side, though, weren't they? I mean, as much as it was basically the same individuals, the formula they'd found in 88 was totally absent in 1990.
I mean, you mentioned them, you know, three of the side winning the European Cup that year, and you just wonder if the emotional effort in doing that and winning the European Cup somehow then makes it difficult to lift yourself going into the next tournament. Because, I mean, you know, if you remember the group stage, they were absolutely terrible in the group stage as well, England and Egypt and on. I mean, this game only happens because the Dutch drew lots with the Irish and lost. So they were established as third in the group. Otherwise, this would have been West Germany against Ireland, and that would have been a whole different game. But no, you're right. I mean, we talked about England in the first one in the group games, the deterioration from 1970 to 1972 that England went through. And this is, with the Dutch, it's not dissimilar. I mean, they don't look anything like that team that won the European Championship. There's no spark about them. There's no... Yeah, and you're still talking about great players, still at the peak of their powers, but just looking nothing like it at all.
Yeah, bizarre. But there we go. Well, Dave, do you want to bring us up into the 21st century now?
After all those goals and all that drama, I feel a bit of a fraud. But this...
Are you going to do it anyway?
This is 2006. It's a pretty prosaic game, really, in a lot of ways. It's Italy against Australia in the round of 16. But it's one of those ones where I like the way that you can find a narrative in the competition when you look back on it. You can't necessarily obviously see it at the time, but I think when you look back at a game or an incident or a personality that started to shape the way that World Cup was going to go. I mean, we talked about Mbappe in the last World Cup in the first one. And I think this one was a significant sort of staging point for Italy going on to win that World Cup in Germany that year. I mean, it was a pretty unremarkable game for the first half. Luca Toni had three or four great chances to score, but the rear end of the care was resolutely untroubled by the banjo. He missed three absolute sitters. And then the game changed sort of early in the second half. Materazzi this doesn't sound right, but it is right. He was actually unlucky to get a straight red card for a challenge. He challenged more of his own man than the Australian. But there was much waving of arms as he marched off the pitch, as you'd expect. And that, I think there was about 40 minutes left in the game. And Australia obviously then had the bulk of the play, but nothing really. They didn't really trouble Italy. And that was when I think Italy came together as a team in that World Cup. I mean, it's standard practice to talk about Italy defending brilliantly, as they did. But there was a real cohesion about it then. Tim Cahill had about the only real chance. He put a free header over the bar. Buffon made a couple of routine saves, nothing you wouldn't expect. And then you're getting into injury time, expecting extra time. Of course, at that point, you would expect Australia with the man advantage in extra time to go and win it. Italy have an attack. Grosso's at the byline. He comes into the box. Lucas Neal goes to ground way too early. And as you would imagine, Grosso accepts the invitation to fall over him and gets the penalty. And then there's a little cameo. All the Italians are rushing over to congratulate him for falling over and winning the penalty. Meanwhile, with the ball, there's Totti, who's only been on for about 15 minutes, having come on, waiting for everybody to bugger off so he can take the penalty. And he's just waiting for the ground to clear. Eventually, he puts the ball there, and he absolutely laces it. He buries it into the roof of the net. And from there, Italy don't really look back. They always look a side that's got that belief. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, as we write books about these things or write articles about them, you know, we're always looking for a thread, for a narrative, and perhaps we exaggerate it sometimes. But looking back at that World Cup, that game and scoring that goal, I think it was probably the 95th minute, that penalty to win it, when had it gone to extra time, you wonder if the 10 men could carry on holding it. That's the moment, I think, when they moved towards winning that World Cup.
Yeah, and very, very unfortunate for Australia, wasn't it? As you say, the circumstances of it, a bitter pill to swallow. Against a team as big as that, this isn't, you know, this is Australia. They'd achieved their biggest result so far. Obviously, they've now got as far again this year, and they're going to face up another giant, aren't they? Argentina in the last 16. But to have done so well against such a strong traditional football nation when they were an emerging one at the time, a golden generation of Australians, of course, at that point, in contrast to what they have now. I mean, this is a team, Australia, of course, they had many, many players, as you talked about there, Dave, who were Premier League regulars, which is something they simply don't have now, and yet they've achieved the same so far. But yeah, a huge turning point for Italy. It's like it wasn't a penalty shootout win, but it sort of feels a bit that kind of way, you know, the big team getting the fortunate break, getting out of a really awkward position by hook or by crook, which is very much the case here, you know, just scraping by, finding a way as it is. And that's the stuff that the big teams seem to manage to do more often than others. I think, I don't know whether it's just familiarity with such a situation or just simply the know-how, the street smarts to get the job done when you're totally up against it. I don't know. That seems to be what it is. And you often see that those who go on to great things, they've come through a situation like this quite often. Maybe not come through it in this way, but maybe it's a penalty shootout, but maybe it's something that there's been this awkward position and they've had to find a way, and they do, and then they go on from there.
There's a huge value, I think, you know, I think you mentioned this the last time, in having won something. Not necessarily you're that team, but your country having won something, having come through something, because you know that it can be done, you know. And if you are, I mean, Australia, at that point, it was probably the best Australian team there's ever been, probably still is. But they were in completely uncharted territory at that point. And I think that level of belief that you have as a team, as a bunch of individuals, that really shouldn't be underplayed, because I think that plays a huge part. You know, we're talking about some of the African nations that we've seen over the last 30 years, really good footballing teams, and yet they still haven't broken that glass ceiling of getting into the last four now, sometimes by extreme misfortune, shall we say. But, you know, they haven't done it. And as you say, in moments like this, Italy will find a penalty in the 95th minute of a game and get through. And I think that's a That's a really big player when you get to these big tournaments. Have you done it before? Have you broken that glass ceiling? If you haven't, I think it's very difficult.
It's a case of the very, very best, kind of like standing up to the circumstances that they find themselves in. You know, for Italy to be down to 10 men, you know, so deep into injury time, and you know, the weight of extra time looming, you know, with a diminished number of players, you know, it's the pivotal moment, you know, and yes, you know, it's a procured penalty. You know, it's not the biggest dive in the world, but he falls over, you know, the offended Australian defender, you know, and I think at the time, I don't think I had particular sympathies for Lucas Neal. I think he'd broken Jamie Carragher's leg a few years earlier. He was one of those that was hard to like. So when this big slice of World Cup misfortune fell his way, you know, it was hard to find sympathy for him. And having that soft spot for Italy as well, you know, I've always missed them at this World Cup just because of that, you know, guarantee of entertainment virtually. You know, either they're going to crash out the group stages and return home to a shower of rotten tomatoes, or they're going to either win the tournament or go home with a, you know, a hard luck story on how they came exceptionally close. So yeah, this was that, you know, big moment where they stood up to the circumstances they found themselves in, and you know, and they passed the test, you know, massively. And like Dave says, you know, they have that track record, and your opponents don't, and that is a big thing. You know, you can prevail from, you know, adversity on the back of deeds that are done. I suppose you could draw a parallel nowadays to the fact that despite all of the money that has been at their disposal, Manchester City still await a first Champions League, as do PSG. Yet a Real Madrid or a Liverpool or, you know, whoever else, you know, still continue to come back and win it again and again and again. And yes, they're still, you know, heavily, you know, financially balanced sides, and you know, they have money at their disposal. But at the same time, you know, it's not an open checkbook. You know, it tends to be, you know, money that's built up, but they've done it over and over again. So, you know, you have that, when you've got that in your war chest, it's a massive, massive advantage. And it doesn't always play out that it plays, you know, it succeeds for you, but more often than not, it does. You know, that concept of putting doubt into the mind of your opponents who have that, as Dave says, that glass ceiling that's there to be broken. You know, for a team that has no glass ceiling as such, you know, because if they're 2006, that's an Italian side that have been world champions three times. You know, they've been European champions, you know, once at that point in time. They are just 6 years on from their last major international final. You know, this is, you know, one of the most significant national teams in the history of world football. And here's Australia in their very first knockout game of a World Cup, you know, having been denied so often qualification, you know, over and over again. You know, because this was, what, was this their first quality? They didn't qualify in 2002, did they? No, they didn't. So this was the first time since 1974, and they'd had all these hard luck stories in losing the playoff matches over and over and over again while they were in the Oceania section, to eventually flourish and come through. You know, with as has been said, some highly significant players in that side. You know, Mark Viduka is part of that team. You know, the Tim Cahill. You know, these are, you know, some fine players. Mark Schwarzer in goal for them. You know, this is a team with a fantastic spine and plenty, Harry Hill, plenty of significant players at their disposal. Yet, you know, because collectively as a national team, you know, Australia haven't achieved much. Yet here's Italy who can pull through and do it again. And this is a work of stubbornness, you know, work of stubborn art by Italy.
Well, you did also mention Italian hard luck stories there and glass ceilings and so on. On the theme of Italian hard luck stories, I'll raise that and add in conspiracy theories and a Korean glass ceiling, an Asian glass ceiling, which I'm going to take us 4 years earlier to Italy, South Korea in 2002. Now, this was an iconic match for all sorts of reasons, one I had to watch in a very long, long, long lunch break from work in a hotel bar across from my office, where we usually watched early morning games with a breakfast roll and a glass of orange juice. At least this was lunchtime because it was late night in Korea. But this was South Korea on, they were under Goose Hiddink, of course, riding a wave of optimism, euphoria, nationalistic fervor, you know, all the crowds red everywhere, the huge chants, everything. It was hugely positive for Korea, this tournament. And yet this game, well, controversially so, they got through it. But they were a well-drilled, energetic, bit of a whirlwind of a team. You know, they'd been together for some time prior to this tournament, rather more successfully than Qatar had this time with a similar approach in 2022. Younger players, crucially, had been encouraged by Hiddink to express themselves, to have the freedom to do so, in contrast to the more natural deference that they'd always had to the older players in the squad, which had possibly held them back at times. That had changed. Now, they'd come through their group beating Poland, then they beat the very highly rated Portugal to come out of the group in first place, whereas Italy, they'd struggled a little bit more. They'd had a win over Ecuador, but that was followed by a defeat to Croatia, and they were losing to Mexico with 5 minutes left of the group and potentially on their way out at that point. A late goal from Del Piero saved them. But I think crucially for this story, Italy had already felt slighted by the officials during the groups. They had 4 goals disallowed across those 3 games, some very much seemingly unjustly. This fed or kick-started the conspiracy theories already brewing in their minds well before this match with South Korea. So that's the sort of background to the Italian mindset as they came into this one. The other host nation, Japan, had been knocked out earlier in the day. So now it's Korea's turn. The crowd, as I say, a huge mass of red, holding up cards, the whole stand saying, again, 1966, held up in white cards with the red background there to reference, of course, Italy's defeat to North Korea in 1966. That's a time where they were pelted with rotten tomatoes on the way home. This time they had a different villain to focus on. This was a very strong Italy team, though, despite their struggles, led by Trapattoni. They had Del Piero, as I've mentioned. There's Vieri, Totti, Inzaghi, Buffon, Maldini, Cannavaro, Nesta. You could go on and on and on. What a stellar lineup of names. But in this match, it's Korea who actually started the best. They won a penalty almost straight away, 4th minute or so, which was magnificently saved by Buffon. Now, the man who missed that penalty, Ahn Jung-hwan, will come back into the story very shortly. But Italy then took control. They took the lead through Vieri. Seemed like the outcome was set, I guess, in terms of general perception, but actually Korea kept pushing. They kept finding space. They never gave up. They were playing neatly, kept creating chances. Now, all the controversy in this game, and there is plenty, mostly comes in extra time. For now, Italy was sort of holding on, but they were sitting deeper and deeper, as is Trapattoni's way. And, you know, you invite pressure, and eventually it seems to be a foolhardy thing at times, and eventually you crack. In this case, it was a late cross coming into the Italian box. Now, Italy's defense seemed to panic a little bit. Panucci flapped at it, and instead of being able to clear the ball, he presented it neatly to Sol Ki-hyun to fire in an equalizer. Just 2 minutes from the end of the game. So Italy had it in their hands. They had it won. Their defensive foul-up really handed it to Korea. But even then, there was still time for Italy to go up the other end and win the game, which they should have done. Now, all the controversy we'll come on to was needless, I guess, in some regard to Italians, because Christian Vieri was presented with an open goal after this equaliser, but before the end of normal time, and he contrived to skew a shot wide. Now, that's something that the general narrative of conspiracy tends to conveniently ignore and forget, is that Italy missed an absolute sitter of a chance to win the game in normal time after Korea's equaliser. But there we go. He did miss, and so it came to extra time. Italy had a goal ruled out for offside for Gattuso. There was another moment where Tomasi, I think, had gone clean through and was set to be one-on-one with the keeper, but it was flagged offside, and it shouldn't have been. There was a red card, or a second yellow, really, for Totti, where the referee, one Byron Moreno of Ecuador, who was slightly behind the pace, it has to be said, he deemed it a dive, but really that wasn't quite the case. It was a very unfortunate red card. So, but off Vieri had to go. So that conspiracy theory in Italian minds that I was talking about is just growing and growing by this point. Both teams had chances, though, in extra time. Korea went close a number of times, notably a free kick drilled under the jumping wall. They didn't have draft excluders in those days. Under the wall and Buffon full stretch diving to just tip it round. So Korea could easily have won it in extra time, just as Italy could have won it in extra time. But 3 minutes from the end, we seem to be heading to penalties. But this is where we have a golden goal now. On Jung Hwan, the aforementioned penalty taker who'd missed, he then sends a header, fabulous header. He leaps above Maldini, just gets the ball, sends it arcing to the corner beyond Buffon. And it's a golden goal and Korea are through and Italy are out. Now, as I say, for Italy, beyond vilifying the squad, as Stephen has said, would happen on many occasions, or finding some other villain. Here, the villain wasn't anyone on the Italian side. For all the failings that they did have, as well as the misfortune, the blame was squarely on Byron Moreno, the referee, for what they saw as all these huge errors, which to their mind were just picking on poor Italy, I guess, would be one way of putting it. The Italian media was convinced it was a stitch-up. The whole thing was a fix. Now, if you read articles about this, there's some that have taken a more objective view given the passage of time. Now, at the time, I had a quote, was it? One paper was stating, "No nation has ever suffered so many injustices Italy has in World Cups." And this was just the biggest of them to their mind. It was slight overreaction. Equally, Arne Jung-Hwan, though, legend has it he was sacked by his Italian club Perugia as a result of this goal, but actually his contract, I think, was coming to an end anyway, so that's not entirely true. But he was slated by the Perugia president for disrespecting or being a traitor to the nation that was paying his wages at the time, which is astonishing. Obviously, he's going to do his best for Korea, as he should. Now, there were obviously refereeing incompetence at times, or linesman incompetence at times, but equally, in terms of conspiracy theories, when you read some of the articles from an Italian perspective too, that have looked back on this game, they'd also cite, had it been a fix, well, what about this incident where he could have sent off an Italian player for an elbow, or this other incident where he unjustly maybe gave a Korean a yellow card, whereas he maybe shouldn't have done, or something along those lines. You know, there were incidents that could have gone either way throughout. Sure, there were undeniably some big calls that went against Italy, however. But, you know, in the cold light of day, I would put it that it wasn't any great conspiracy. These decisions were nothing particularly worse than made by other officials. It's just there were a few of them in quick succession. Italian minds feeding on the injustices they felt they'd already had in the group were set clear on their path to conspiracy, and everything they saw just fed into that narrative. A lot of people would agree with them in this particular game. You know, Korea obviously went on to get past Spain in the quarterfinal with another dubious decision going their way, where Spain, the goal was disallowed, saying the ball had gone out prior to it, and it hadn't. Again, just feeding the Italian narrative that it was all on for pushing Korea onto unprecedented heights at the expense of the old world, I guess. But, you know, it was a fascinating game nonetheless, one that I struggled to get back to work from because it just went on and on and on. And yeah, several people just didn't turn up back to the office that afternoon, including the two Korean guys who I worked with who were just stood in the corner of the bar grinning away. So it was quite a memorable occasion for all sorts of reasons. But what do you think? Conspiracy, yes or no?
I'd say no. You know, it's just one of those games where, you know, there's some poor officiating going on. I've got to remember as well that World Cup had this ludicrous eye at the storm where, you know, big team after big team fell flat on the face. You know, Argentina went out in the group stages, Portugal went out in the group stages, you know, they had this defeat for Italy, Spain would then go out. France in the group stages. So, you know, this was a World Cup that was, I don't know, it was the shocks were refreshing to start with, but they were more unsettling as they continued. Because, you know, for me, you know, a World Cup, I want to see some heavyweight clashes in there. And these results and these turns of events, you know, exits of the group stages and you know, knockouts by South Korea. And this is where we ended up with Turkey in the semi-finals and the USA very narrowly, you know, almost matching them. You know, it wasn't. It was only an excellent performance from Oliver Kahn that saved Germany in the quarterfinals. So yeah, it was just the bizarrest of World Cups in that respect. So yeah, you know, sometimes you've just got to take it on the chin. It's a bit like I mean, I had all sorts of interesting conversations with Leeds United supporters as with regards to the 1975 European Cup final, for instance. And you know, yes, you know, you're losing circumstances in which there's been poor officiating. You want to find the conspiracy. You want to find the answer to it to ease the pain of it. And sometimes it just comes down to poor officiating. And I think this was it. I'm not saying that it doesn't go on and it hasn't gone on and it won't go on in the future. But, you know, I don't buy into this one as far as it being a conspiracy.
It's interesting that it's the Italians on the receiving end, because much as I love Italian football, if there's any match fixing to be done, you'd think it'd be
it's the opposite
they
way.
They know a thing or two about it. They do know a thing or two about it, don't they?
I think they just got into that mindset that the world was against them. I was watching a little bit of it earlier on today, and there is one point where Del Piero does get elbowed in the face on the edge of the box, and he's so shocked he forgets to fall over. He just sort of wheels around for a bit and carries on, you know. So I think they got it into their heads that something was going on. Of course, doesn't help that the referee a few years later was arrested for smuggling heroin into JFK.
Well, he was quite a character, old Byron Moreno, wasn't he?
6 kilos in his underwear, which is quite some feat to stash 6 kilos of heroin into your underwear. I don't know quite where he put it all.
I think with this game as well, it's the remonstrations of Trapattoni on the bench as well. You know, he thumps the dugout as such. You know, there's a lot of punching of walls and of you know, haranguing of officials on the touchline that is just, you know, a magnificent thing. But it is one of those that, you know, he'd been so successful at club level for Juventus and Inter, and even his wild times at Bayern Munich, and you know, he built this, put this Fiorentina side together that wasn't a million miles away from success itself. You know, everything he touched turned to gold, and you know, there was almost a given that he would, you know, ascend to the Italian job at some point, and you know it. And when he would take an Italian side to a World Cup, it wasn't meant to end that way. It wasn't meant to end at the last 16 in controversial circumstances. You know, he was meant to win the thing. You know, he'd won so much in the past, and you know, this kind of jarred, you know, for us non-Italians watching it. So yeah, for Italians, it must have been, you know, it's got to be way up there with their problems with the North, with Haiti and all of that. You know, they beat Haiti in 74, but they had some serious issues with them. You know, it's just one of the great characteristic games of any World Cup, really, when it comes to the last 16.
I think it's something, because it was the host they were against, that I know you talked about lots of the shocks and so on, and there were a lot in this World Cup, and it diminished the quality as it went on towards the end. But I think seeing the hosts come through in such dramatic circumstances, that given Japan had just lost earlier in the day, it was kind of a nice way for it to continue to have this incredible, iconic, dramatic match go Korea's way. Plus also the Italian meltdowns. There's something funny about that. You talk about Trapattoni smashing the dugout, but a lot of the players, the way they were yelling in the face of the referee and just losing their heads at times. There's something beautifully comic about that that's quite entertaining to see as well.
I think what you got to throw in there as well is that 2002 squad, that core side was infinitely stronger on paper than the one that would win the World Cup 4 years later. You know, look at, you know, the field in Marco Materazzi in 2006, and that's a culture shock for someone who's played for Everton. You know, I find it mad now that I'm looking at a World Cup where Brighton players are playing for Argentina. You know, it's such a bizarre thing. You know, so you know, I think this is the genesis of it, because I'm looking at that and thinking, Marco Materazzi, who was just kind of like, a perpetual yellow card, recipient in an Everton shirt. Going on to not just win the World Cup, but to play such a ludicrously pivotal role in it by scoring a goal and provoking that headbutt. So 4 years earlier, that's a role, that is filled by Paolo Maldini, with a much suaver effect. It was a big step in kind of like the direction that Italy, currently hold. Yes, they are the reigning European champions, but, we are now two World Cups without them, and it's a bizarre thing that by the time the 2026 World Cup rolls around, should Italy qualify, it'll be 20 years since they last won a game in the finals of the World Cup. Since then, the last four World Cups have been, group stage exit, failed to qualify. This is truly, truly incredible as far as the Italian national side is concerned. I've seen in my lifetime win two World Cups, win a European Championship, lose a European Championship, you lose a further World Cup final. The strength of that 2002 side was, absolutely amazing. And of course, there'd been a campaign for Trapattoni to take Roberto Baggio that he resisted. There was just such strength in depth. The amazing players that didn't go to that World Cup in the name of Italy, who were sat at home watching this unfold. I'm sure some of them, had a slight enjoyment almost of how this unfolded, on the back of not being selected by Trapattoni.
I think Maldini's one of the great World Cup tragic heroes, isn't he? If you think of his time, 1990, lost a semi-final on penalties. 94, lost a final on penalties. 98, lost a quarter-final on penalties. 2002, goes out in this match.
Yeah.
And then 4 years later, when he's not there, what happens? They go and win it,
yeah.
Unlucky for a great player. But anyway, we better wrap things up before we're here all night and Stephen's late for his radio appointment. So good luck with that, Stephen. You get to talk 1990 World Cup all over again. Hope you managed to convince them on the airwaves of what your views are of that tournament.
I get to upset an entire generation. I'm expecting to lose followers on Twitter on the back of tonight. significant numbers shall vanish, I'm sure. And it won't be Elon Musk's fault.
Well, good luck with that. And thank you very much, Dave, for your contributions.
A pleasure as ever. Always good to talk about the World Cup's past.
Indeed. And obviously the next episode of this, we'll be moving on to the quarterfinals and some more great games from the past, no doubt. We can even go further back than the 80s there when we can pick a few more when the quarterfinals have been going strong. So, do look out for that one coming your way soon. But thanks very much for listening for now. And thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.